the lower steps, people started leaving.
It's very common.
Is that the norm?
Uh-huh. It's very common.
Lower steps, not the lead walk.
All right, welcome back, everyone. I know everybody's full, so we're all going to try to stay awake. We're going to start off with 2 minutes of meditation and see what happens. Serenity prayer, God.
Lord, grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
So, I'm going to say a few words about the sane and sound sex ideal. I'm going to swing it back to Mike for step five. Then I'm going to do six and seven. And that's what we're going to try to cover in this session. And Mike will probably cover step eight in this session. So, on page 69, it says, in this way, we tried to shape a sane and sound ideal for our future sex life. We subject each relation to this test. Was it selfish or not? We ask God to mold our ideals and help us live up to them. Skip down to the next paragraph. Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we've done harm, provided that we do not still bring about more harm doing so. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. That prayer can be used in any area. So, when you answer those nine questions on page 69, the very last question is what I should have done instead. And when I'm taking people through the steps, and specifically newer guys, they're going to have multiple relationships that they're going to inventory using those nine questions. And so at the last question, when I'm listening to a fifth step, I get out a piece of paper, and every time they answer the question what I should have done instead, sometimes they'll say I shouldn't have got involved. I say that's never the answer. I want to look at the behavior you engaged in that led to the downfall of the relationship. And let's do the opposite. So, you know, I hid my struggles from my wife. So I'm open with my wife. I didn't communicate honestly. So now I want to communicate honestly. I never asked if her emotional needs were being met. Okay, I want to ask if her emotional needs are being met on a regular basis. I never discussed my schedule with her to see when we could create some date nights for our relationship. And so we talk once a week about a date night once a month or twice a month. So I'm using my own marriage as an example because I was with Marcy for almost 7 years and happy for about a little over 5 years. In the 5 years that we were happy and content, I would share my sane and sound sex ideal with her. So every time I go through the steps, I started molding my ideal. And every 3 months, I would sit down and I'd read it to her, and she'd give me a report card to see how I was doing. And I got more bad report cards than I did good, but I was unaware of it. But the beautiful thing about even getting the report card is I would make corrective measures, and then things would get really good, and then I'd fall asleep. And then right around the time I fall asleep again, it's time to get a new report card. You guys see what I'm talking about? This is one of the most effective things you can do for your relationship if you want to grow towards it. I watch people, first they don't know what a sane and sound ideal is. They've never written one, and it's in the big book. And they never use it. They write it and they stick it in a drawer somewhere and they never refer to it. So, I mean, I wrote it out and I kept it and I showed it to her and it was on my phone, so I had access to it. So if you really want to see some changes in your relationship, I would invite you to try it. Now, it's not a coincidence that my marriage fell apart, and in those last 18 months, I didn't do any of that. There was no sharing of a sane and sound sex ideal with Marcy because I knew I wasn't doing anything close to it. I checked out of my marriage. So I wanted to share that because it's overlooked and not enough people are using specific instructions in our big book. That one question, what I should have done instead, will shape your conduct in future relationships. It's an ideal to live up to. Ask God for help. But in order to do that, there's got to be some accountability. And in a relationship, the only person that can give you the accountability is your partner. Okay? So I just wanted to share that on that piece of the fourth step.
So what have we done? Page 75 or 74 in the big book. That next to the last paragraph on page 70 says, if I've been thorough about my personal inventory, I've written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. I have begun to comprehend their fertility and their fatality. We on page 70?
70?
Yeah. It might not be that in the fourth edition. It's the last little bit of how it works. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill towards men, even my enemies, for I look on them as sick people. I have listed the people I have hurt by my conduct and am willing to straighten out the past if I can. Page 72, into action. First couple of lines of 72 gives me my intent for doing a fifth step. It says, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We have been trying to get a new attitude and a new relationship with our Creator and to discover the obstacles in our path. So the intent for a fifth step is to get a new attitude and a new relationship with my Creator, and to discover the obstacles in my path. We didn't talk very much about intents behind each step, but for each step, there's an intent. This little book, Soul Food, Wisdom and Inspiration to Feed Your Spirit, it says, hungry? There is certainly no shortage of things to eat in this world. Fresh fruit and veggies, steak and mashed potatoes, biscuits and gravy, all kinds of good stuff to fill our stomach. Or you can fill your brain with nonstop music, thrilling action shows, and every sort of visual distraction you can name. Everyone with any kind of appetite can find something to fill up on. Of course, hunger for the entertaining or the edible comes back pretty quickly. But hey, that's life. Or is it? According to God, he promises something better. Come to me, he says. Let me carry those burdens for a while. Let me rub your tired feet, sort out the confusion, feed your spirit. And what God feeds us keeps us full of joy, full of hope. God's food is truly soul food. It does much more than tantalate the senses. And although it doesn't come in a wrapper, if it had a nutrition label, we'd see that it offers us 100% of our daily allowance of everything we need to thrive, and then some. So what have I done in the fifth step? I've admitted to God, to myself, and another human being the exact nature of my defects. Down the page it says a solitary self-appraisal is insufficient, meaning I need to be transparent with somebody. I need to share all of me with somebody. I need to have faith and be willing to believe that in this process I will shed what's needed in order for me to get free. It says if we skip this vital step, we may not overcome drinking or using. That's a warning. And as you move throughout the process of recovery outlined in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's a number of warnings. So it says, if you that who? That mad dog? This is a step that you can't skip. Fifth step. Only way you can do a fifth step is to write a fourth step. Trying to admit this humbling experience, they have turned to easier, softer ways. And inevitably, they got drunk. We move over to page 74. This was pointed out to me after I had done a few fifth steps and one fifth step. Naturally, it was pointed out to me by Mark Husham. The top of the page says, rightly and naturally, we think well before we choose the person or persons with whom to take this intimate and confidential step. There's your multiple fifth steps. Sharing your inventory with more than one person. My sponsor used to say, how free do you be? You want to be. So I've read inventory to a number of people in a circle where we each read inventory to each other. I've searched out different individuals to read inventory to. There was a time I was directed to read to a minister or a priest. I didn't know exactly who I was going to read to. This was very early before I got into my religious practice. I just drove down the street and Spirit said stop. I went into a cathedral and read to a priest. Didn't know it. I've read to family members. I've read to, I can't remember if she was a spouse or a girlfriend, but I've read the entire inventory to them. I've read to my brother. It's a freedom when you take your clothes off, and not literally take your clothes off, but when you disrobe in somebody else and let them get to see you and know you. We talked about deep, dark secrets. We talked about being upon a life and death errand. Then on 75, after you've disclosed your inventory, they give you some fifth step promises. And that's another piece we haven't really talked about this weekend, but behind each step there's promises. And they're outlined in the Big Book. Every single step has promises attached to it. Here on 75, it says, once having taken this step, withholding nothing, two key words there, withholding nothing, we are delighted. promises. Being delighted, look the world in the eye. I'm on 75, second, third paragraph. Be alone at perfect peace and ease. Fear falls from us. Begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but now we begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem or the using problem has disappeared will come strongly. Feel you are on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. And after you finish the fifth step, you need to reflect on that paragraph and ask yourself, are you feeling any of that? And that's true for any step that you go through. After you finish movement through that step, contemplate, have you been aligned with some of the promises that have been promised you in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous? And if you haven't, look for them. A promise means it's something that's to come true. They give you an exercise to do after you do a fifth step. It's called returning home. And they give you a number of spiritual exercises to consider before you turn the page into step six. And that exercise is to reflect back on everything you've done from step one up until this point. And they ask you very specific stuff in this paragraph. We first thank God, then we take our big book down, and we begin to review each proposal, meaning each step that I've come through. They ask you, are your stones in place? What are the stones? Three stones. Somebody tell me what they are.
Cornerstone.
And what else? And what else? Cornerstone, keystone, and there's one more.
Foundation.
Foundation in the first step, cornerstone in the second step, keystone in the third step. They ask you, have you skimped on your cement in your first step? Forming your foundation. Meaning, have you not gone to meetings and you're in the recovery process? Are you in the recovery? Are you going to meetings and you're not in the recovery process? Meaning, are you in the problem and not in the solution? Or are you in the solution and not in the problem? Meaning, your problem is treated by you going to meetings and being around people like you, the fellowship. Being here this weekend, you're treating the physical part of your disease, the unity part of the circle and triangle. Being in the recovery process and moving through the steps as we did this weekend, you're treating your mind. You're in the solution. So it's very clear what they ask you, and they want to keep you awake and alert to what's happening in your life. Why? Because they want you to recover. They want you to be free once and for all, not ever having to return. Have you skimped on your cement? Have you tried to make mortar without sand? So you need those two ingredients in your foundation. It's what you will stand on for the rest of your recovery. Fellowship and solution on a consistent basis. So 30 years later, I still go to a number of meetings each week. On a regular basis, I don't go through the steps every year, but at least every 2 years, every 2.5 years, I'm doing a piece of work. I'm now in the ninth step again for the umpteenth time and completing amends. So you want to stay in this paragraph until you're absolutely sure you've done and reviewed everything they've asked you to do. And when you're crystal clear, absolutely sure, positively, without a shadow of a doubt, they ask you to turn the page. And that's to look at step six. We're going to let Derek T. talk to you about step six.
Thanks, Mike. The devastating effects of addiction on physical and emotional health and social functioning have been meticulously cataloged, but far less attention has been given to its toll on character and the role character reconstruction plays in the recovery process. A recent rereading of David Brooks' Road to Character has spurred this reflection on character and addiction recovery. All illnesses have the potential to distort character as well as diseases, particularly in shrinking one's world to a state of near complete self-absorption. But addiction is unique with the annals of medical disorders in the extremes to which one's unique essence is distorted as the disorder progresses. By radically reordering personal priorities, addiction ultimately sacrifices all of its personal commitments and aspirations to serve to this higher need. It shrinks one's world and hollows one out, leaving only this insatiable need and the painful consequences of serving it at the center of oneself. Addiction medicine, actually all medicine, is ill-equipped to address such pathologies of character and to fill the void once drugs are removed from the center of an addicted patient's life. The person seeking addiction recovery is left with the same challenge. How does one escape such chemically induced narcissism within a culture that not just worships the self, but has itself become a selfie culture? I ran across this article and I was pretty fascinated by it. So, recovery in this view requires replacing the I language of alienation with the we language of human connection, shedding the selfie culture and embracing a culture of humility, tolerance, interdependence, and community. It involves shifting the focus from the exclusive needs of the self to the needs of the world and the community, reframing the question, what do I want from life, to what does life want from me? So, the longer I stay on this path, the more I become aware that spirituality has to do with character refinement. When I went through the steps the first time, step six and seven were really quick. I came out of my fifth step. I did returning home. We came out with some general broad, you know, I'm lazy, I procrastinate, I'm selfish, I do what I want to do when I want to do it, I don't think about anybody else, I'm dishonest. All these things came out of that first fifth step, and I just said the prayer. Are you willing? Of course. I said the prayer, moved on to step eight. I wrote an article. I was asked to write an article about step six a few years ago. I want to share this article that I wrote because it has everything that I really want to say to all of you about it. In the big book, step six is one small paragraph between our completion of step five when we return home and our readiness to approach God in step seven and humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. If we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six. We emphasize willingness as being indispensable. Are we not ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can He now take them away, every one? If we still cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. Those are specific instructions for step six. In my first passage of step six came and went rather quickly and abruptly. It was difficult for me to differentiate step six from step seven. Looking back, it seems as if I took both steps at the same time. My sponsor asked, "Are you willing?" I answered yes. He then instructed me to review the list of broad and general defects, which became apparent during my fifth step. The list included selfishness, dishonesty, jealousy, envy, and inconsideration. Since I was willing, I asked God to remove them in step seven, and we moved on to step eight. Don't misunderstand me. It was exactly how I was supposed to work the step. But since then, step six has proven to be so much deeper than my initial experience with the step. For the next 18 months, when I heard other members say, these are the steps, specifically six and seven, which separate the men from the boys, I discounted their statement. I directed them to get off their asses and go help someone work the steps. Why did I exhibit so much hostility? I believe it was due to my lack of experience with step six. Around that same time, I was introduced to the concept of revisiting the first nine steps, mainly reworking the steps in general. I was open to this idea because I found myself suffering a great deal. I was easily annoyed by most, often uneasy and dissatisfied with my life. I knew there was more. When I reflect back, it's evident to me in the beginning, the only thing which truly changed was my willingness to do whatever I had to do to recover from my addiction. At the outset, little else about my character changed because I was not entirely ready. This is the departure point for me. Step six is not only about willingness, although it's vital. It's about asking myself, am I entirely ready? Over the last 7 years, I've discovered the vitality and necessity of reworking the first nine steps on a regular basis. In that work, I uncovered the difference between willingness and being entirely ready. I've been willing to have many defects and shortcomings removed, but entire readiness only emerged when they became objectionable. The defect's last flicker of value must be snuffed out before it becomes objectionable. Otherwise, it will remain. I will continue to do something as long as I'm getting something from it. I also discovered a defect is usually removed or goes into remission while I'm going through a great deal of pain and suffering as a result of the defect in action. In my experience, as long as I'm getting something of value from the defects or shortcomings, they're going to continue to show up. I will not be entirely ready, and I'll be unable to ask God with humility and authenticity to remove them. I'll continue to believe I can do something to change myself. I've become ready when I experience my utter powerlessness to remedy the situation and change myself. Let me end with this. My attitude has changed regarding defects and shortcomings. These personal struggles are now blessings, and I thank God from the bottom of my heart for them, because it is God who is refining my character by blessing me with the pain caused by my defects and my shortcomings. In short, it is these very things which bring me back to the table with God. Without the struggles behind my defects, I would not know where the growth needs to take place. Without the darkness of my struggles, I would not know the light of my victory. And that's a perspective. I watch a lot of people try to remove their defects. I watch a lot of people try to work on their resentments. Big Book says selfishness is going to kill me and I can't do anything about it. I must have God's help. Big Book says these resentments must be mastered, but how? We can't wish them away any more than alcohol and drugs. Over and over it is telling us to go to God, to expect the presence of God. So these defects, I wish sometimes the Big Book would not say they're going to be cast out, because my experience has been just like alcoholism and addiction, which is my worst character defect. Has it been cast out? Alcoholism and addiction have gone into remission. And if I don't continue the treatment, which is the 12 steps, can my alcoholism and my addiction come out of remission? Absolutely. I think the same thing applies for these defects of character and these shortcomings. Now, stealing was immediately cast out, right? Outright lying, for the most part, was immediately cast out when I went through the steps. But see, the ego, it's crafty, and it's very slick, and it changes. It still operates in the same fashion, but the way it shows up begins to change. The way I manipulated 10.5 years ago is nothing compared to the way I can manipulate now. The ego has really figured out some really baffling ways to do things. The way I deliver information, the way I leave information out, it's just there. Anybody that says it's not, the ego, that's its job. And so I've watched some guys I've sponsored over the years become very resentful when their defect comes back. It goes away for a long time, and then all of a sudden it comes back, and they literally think this entity called God decided one day, I'm going to give this guy back this defect, right? It's a very dualistic view of God. And for me, the way I have embodied these defects is they are, they're sacred in a way, because they are constantly, when I struggle with my defects, there is a honing and a polishing that's happening to me, right? I'm changing on some level. Now, does this give me an excuse to just run amok? Absolutely not. But because I think this way, I have a dialogue with someone I'm close to about it. Maybe Mike, maybe Brandon, maybe Ralph. Somebody I'm going to talk to about something that I'm rubbing up against and I have some serious friction with. The other thing of my defects, they show me how lack of power is still my dilemma. How beautiful is that? There's a mercy and a grace in that. And for whatever reason, I'm continually drawn back into this work when these defects show up and take over. So, you know, there's a thing about living. There's this, the gentleman, this guy Krishnamurti, this is Tarek's opinion, okay, disclaimer. I read something in one of his books that just floored me. He said it is pointless to live by ideals and principles. And I was like, what is this guy talking about? He said, as long as you try to live by ideals and principles, being a human, you're going to set your ideals and principles here, and you're always going to show up here. And you'll spend your entire existence trying to close the gap, and you will not be present to the awareness or consciousness of God. You won't be. You'll be too busy trying to close the gap and change yourself. And so I've always gone back and forth about my beliefs around that concept, but I see a lot of validity in it. Because when I did the exercise, Mike took me through the steps back in 2014, and he told me to go find three people to go ask them what it looks like when I do what I want to do, when I want to do it without little consideration for anyone else. That's the way I phrased it to him, because a lot of people outside the program, you ask them, hey, tell me what my life run on self-will looks like, they're like, what the hell are you talking about? Nobody out in the real world uses the word self-will on a regular basis, right? We use that in here. And so I changed it so I could get them to understand what I was looking for. And the VP of my company at the time, he said, Tarek, you know what? It just breaks my heart because I just see you constantly not being okay with who you are. You're always wanting to do something to change yourself, and you don't sit still. And that was intense for me to hear. I meditate. I was like, what the fuck are you talking about? I don't sit still. I meditate every day. Of course I'd sit still. Like, I was very defensive and very protective, but he was right. And then the second person I went to in that exercise said the same thing, that I'm always constantly trying to change myself. There's something to that. And so I've embraced my shortcomings and my defects. And I have, well, who was it that said, if you're not having fun with your defects, something's wrong?
Go home.
Yeah. And so to me, step seven is the it's such an important step, because you want to go to your creator with all the egg on your face. You want to go with all your imperfection and say, God, I still need you. I am poverty stricken, and I hope I stay poverty stricken when it comes to God. And my defects is one of the ways that happens, because I always need help. I always need God, because I can't do anything to fix the problem. All right? It's a beautiful thing. One more thing about 6 and 7. My defects have now become the codes and values that I live by. So I'm going to share some of my defects, current defects, with you. I have to be important. So I start, the way I operate in relationships will back that up. And if you're doing something that reduces my importance, we're going to have a problem. And most likely, you're going to end up on my resentment inventory. So there's an underlying principle, a self-defeating principle, that I believe is one of my biggest character flaws. Here's another one. The belief that my time is more important than your time. That shows up the way I treat people sometimes. My employees specifically. Here's another one. The belief that God owes me something. This is one of my current defects. The belief that control equals security. If I'm in control, I'll be safe. So To me, when I write resentment inventory, it's about getting to the third column and finding out what codes and values I'm truly living by. And that, at the end of the day, is what the whole inventory is about. Because the names no longer matter. It's these self-defeating principles, which I call shortcomings, that are eating my lunch. Right? If I don't think God will... If I think ultimately I'm going to fail, then that's going to cause me to procrastinate. Because I don't want to do it, because I think I'm going to fail. There's an underlying limiting belief underneath it all. So this is my perspective on 6 and 7. You can have some fun with these steps. And I will be the first to say that I used to jump down people's throats at meetings. I just wanted to talk about 6 and 7. I thought you needed to go sponsor somebody. And the funny thing is I have 5 or 6 sponsees and I'm riddled. My defects are all hanging out. Right. And I'm like, Mike, I tell sponsees to get in relationships because there's nothing like a good relationship to bring all the damn defects to the surface. Right? How are you ever supposed to learn to be in relationship if you're not in relationship? I've always been fascinated by that. There's one other thing I wanted to share with y'all. I think that's it for now. I'll jump back in if I can remember.
Just a couple other things on 6 and 7. And it centers around defects.
I remember. I say it real quick. Yeah. As we move into steps 8 and 9, one thing I want everyone to be mindful of is the miracle of steps 6 and 7 is experienced in the action of 8 and 9 often. So think about it. If you make your amends, and I'm talking make a lot of amends, and you sit across the table from people, and you look into their eyes, and they get to describe to you what your defects do to other people. Over and over, there's something that happens that causes the defects to go back into remission when you're able to look at people. And, you know, the big book says selfish and inconsiderate habits kept the home in turmoil. When they talk about the tornado roaring through people's lives, it doesn't say alcoholism or drinking kept the home in turmoil. It says selfish and inconsiderate habits. And so when you make a lot of amends, yeah, a lot of it has to do with the addiction, but we did a lot of horrific stuff stone cold sober. And so making the amends, well, you will experience these miracles called step 6 and 7. Like some of these defects will go into remission the more you sit down and take ownership of your life in front of people. And they ask you, or they tell you what you can do to make things right. And you go out and make things right. And you do it over and over. And they just go into remission. You know, I know a lot of you know exactly what I'm talking about. But, you know, for you newer people, you're not going to quite understand this phenomenon that I'm talking about until you go through the experience yourself. So I just wanted to make sure I hit on that. That's it.
Can I ask you where that was today? What's the question?
What page is the tornado? Like 75, 76?
Oh, 83, 84, 86, somewhere back there.
Oh, bottom of page 82. Page 82.
Page 82?
Yeah. The crackhead is like a tornado roaring his way through the lives of others. Hearts are broken, sweet relationships are dead, affections have been uprooted. Selfish and inconsiderate habits have kept the home in turmoil.
Wow.
Bottom of page 82.
Bottom of 82, last paragraph.
Selfish and inconsiderate habits
have kept the home in turmoil.
If you read it, it's right there. Bottom of 82. So, just a couple things to add. Those of you that got the workbook, each step is mapped out in the workbook for you. There's a couple things that I've added to it. Dealing with defects of character. How about disguised defects of character? How about stuff that's in hiding? Stuff like lust. Dressed up as liking. I come to you and say, I like you. You're really a nice person. But really, I'm lusting after you. What I really want to do is go to bed with you. Lust dressed up as liking. How about greed dressed up as ambition? You got one job and it's enough. You pay the bill. You're able to do a couple things besides pay the bill. But you just got to have another job because your head tells you that's not enough. We need to make more money. And you're being ambitious. Greed dressed up as ambition. Control dressed up as concern. How many times we tell somebody we're concerned about them, but what we're really trying to do is control them? So disguise defects of character. You have some mapped out under steps 6 and 7 in your workbook. Dishonesty dressed up as rationality. Lust dressed up as love. I love you. And again, all I'm doing is lusting after you. How many of y'all have told somebody you loved them and all you didn't want to do was get them into bed? Raise your hand. Raise your hand. Disguised defects. There's a bunch of them. Besides the obvious, when you do this as a spiritual exercise, God will begin to reveal stuff to you that you didn't even know was a part of your life, and you were doing it. But again, God has an agenda. His agenda is to get you free. And this process outlined in this book, being divinely inspired, will do just that. As a result of moving through it in a spiritual way, it will begin to bring stuff out of you that you didn't even know existed. Another little piece, aspects of character. There's something I do with people that I work with when we're doing a fifth step. Aspects of character. That means part of me, there's something that I've taken on as a way to live that's become a part of my character that has turned on me and it don't work no more. Where at one time in my life it did work and it served a purpose because it helped me to live, whether it was dishonest or not. But now where I'm at in my life, wanting evolution, wanting to be recreated, it's worthless. It don't work no more. Example. People have to act a certain way for me to be all right. Aspect of character. Men are better than women. Machoism. A lot of us guys, we grew up with that. Limited in our ideas of what we think about you. Have put you in a little slot. That awakened me to the fact one day that you probably need a female sponsor, Mike. No, I'm not going to say probably. Spirit said you need a female sponsor. Why? Because you don't know nothing about it. You think you do. But look at the way you've treated them all your life. You tried to treat them like another man. In moments, I'm kind and understanding and loving as best as I could. I practically always had an agenda behind that. Not realizing that on a number of levels, the female is different than the man, than the male. You dress different. You go to bathroom different. You process emotion different. You eat differently. Whole bunch of stuff. Ever since that point, I've had a female sponsor to help me with my woman stuff. Because I don't understand it. There's a book that says men are from Mars and women are from Venus or Venus or whatever. Yeah. Y'all know what I'm talking about, right? Yeah. Right on. Right on. Completely different. An aspect of character, and growing up the way I did, I grew up with fixed ideas about women. And basically what it did is it put you all in a little slot that if you got out of it, how dare you be out of your slot? When you're entitled to be out of your slot, what makes me any better than you? You're a child of God. God created you the same way He created me. He wants you to have the same freedoms. So, they're called aspects of character. based in my belief system. One more. I have to be on top. I have to have the control. If I don't have it, I'll die. So I go to any length to get the control that I need to be top dog, numero uno, whole deal. And I don't stop. I run it in the ground. But it no long, at one time it might have served me, but it don't serve me no more, because every time I use it, I run up against a brick wall with somebody. I don't create friendships and relationships, I create enemies. But what I find out is that this aspect of character, I don't have the power to remove it. Sometimes I'm awake to it too. So it's something that I take to God. T tapped on it. I don't work on defects and aspects of character. Whenever I do a piece of work and get the 6 and 7, and what comes out of it, I take it to God. I read my list. I mark off the ones that I'm willing for God to take, and the ones that I'm not willing for Him to take, I'm totally honest with it. No, I don't want you to take that right now. And I ask God to show me where it needs to be removed. And I stay in 6 until I get the willingness to have God take it. And then I move. But I was talking to somebody the other day, because we seem to think that because we take it to God and ask Him to remove it, He's going to take it away. Some things He lets you keep. I keep talking about this other book, right? This guy in this other book, where he had a thorn in his side, and he said to the master, "Take the thorn out, please. Would you take the thorn out?" And he said, "I'm not taking it out, no." And in essence, what he was saying, that I'm not taking it out, because if I take it out, you might not ever come back to me. There's some stuff there that's meant to stay there, so that when it gets bad enough and painful enough, you turn back to the power. Yeah.
So why not move on before you're completely ready to give them all up?
Because it says completely willing. The language in the big book is specific, and I need to abide by that language. So it says completely willing. It doesn't say I'm willing for Him to take it. It doesn't say that, okay, He's going to take it. I'm just willing for you to take it. Because I see it doesn't serve me anymore. And what is my purpose turning into? My purpose is evolving into God taking my life and my will. And we're in steps 4 through 9. That's the process of saying to God, "I'm serious about this decision I made in step 3. Here's what I'm willing to do to let you know I'm serious. I'll face to be rid of, step 4. I'll sit down with some people and be transparent with them. I'll look at these things that block me from you and become willing for you to take them. I'm not going to be concerned with whether you take them, but I'm willing because it blocks me from you. You with me?" And then in the next step, 2 steps that we're going to talk about, I'm ready to move into the ultimate surrender. Steps 8 and 9 is the ultimate surrender.
Is willingness not an action?
No. Willingness is not an action. You can't. If I could have changed me, I would have changed me at 19. I knew something was wrong with me at 19 years old.
Until I was willing to let go of the drugs and prayed for willingness, because I couldn't figure it out. I was stuck in praying for willingness.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually it was answered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So was that not an action?
No. You just prayed. You prayed for willingness. If you want to call it an action, you can. But it's just the willingness. You finally got the willingness. You didn't do anything else besides pray. You took action, yeah, by praying.
I think one of the things we got to remember here in this 7th step is the most important aspect of the 7th step, in my opinion, is the humility that's required to go to your Creator in the seventh step with egg on your face and all your imperfections and say, God, my third step now has teeth on it.
Because we don't do that. We don't do that. What do? We run on self. We make our way. I'm not coming to you and asking you for nothing. I'm going to go get it. But I finally get to a place in my life where I see I can't make it happen. But I become willing to believe that there is a power that can. And it's really based in one thing. It's based in all the way back to step one. If something don't happen here, I'm getting loaded again. If something don't happen here, I'll never have power to live life in any type of healthy, prosperous, and advantageous way. I'll never really know what love is. One of my greatest deals about me today is to live and give without expectations, unconditionally. Because all my life I've been conditioned to, with love comes conditions. Guess what? Still happening today. I ain't perfect. I'm the first one to tell you I ain't perfect. He's still working on me. Why? Because I'm a what?
Mad dog.
But it's a far cry from what I was when I first got here. Far cry. So, separation, men from boys, women from girls, surrender, and moving into 8 and 9, the ultimate surrender. Ultimate surrender, I know that to be disturbed about one's life and their fears, even for an instant, is not to trust God. I know that God is taking care of me. I trust His loving care in everything that I do. If things seem to go wrong, I am not disturbed. My life and affairs may be seeking a balance, but my highest good is sure to come out of action. My highest good is sure to come out of action. I loved the divine law of life, and I trusted in every part of my life. Nothing can offend me. If someone speaks harshly to me or seeks to take advantage of me, it does not disturb me. My peace is assured. My life is untroubled, for I trust in the Lord. I dwell in a circle of love, and nothing but love can enter that circle. My awareness of the presence of God in my life is my sure defense against all seeming evil. In the clear, bright light of truth, there is no darkness or confusion. Nothing troubles me. I do not give or receive offense. Love is the law of my life. Great peace is mine. And so it is. How do you get here? You get here by surrendering. Ninth step is the ultimate surrender. But before you get to 9, you got to make a list. One of the shortest pieces or the shortest steps in the big book, and they actually put 8 and 9 together. And basically what you're doing is you're going to continue a list that you should have started in your fifth step when reading inventory. The harm that you created. Don't consider whether you're willing to make them or not. Just put the name down. When you see the harm that you've done as a result of reading what? Your fourth column. That piece I told you to do about living in the life of Maryland?
Maryland.
Okay. Correct. Life in the land of Mary. And when I look at the fourth column, I see, my God, I wouldn't want to live there with me either. And I see the harm that I've created all down the stretch, the journey. 82, what we just read. we come in and we think just not drinking and not using is enough. And we don't realize there's a lot of repairing to be done. But I become willing. And I become willing why? Because of what I've seen all the way back in step one. And the truth about step one for me, I don't know what it is for you, but the truth about step one for me is that I'm shooting dope again. Sure as my name is Mike, I'm shooting dope again. Why?
Because you're a mad dog.
Because I'm a mad dog and Heron knows I love it. And it's like that relationship that, and somebody in here, you just like me. You was in that relationship and you loved her and she loved you, but you went left and she went right. You know, but still together, and there was a part of you that knew, man, I can't do this no more. But you just couldn't get away. You just couldn't get out of that relationship. You did everything that you could. And you'd get away for a couple of minutes, and the phone would ring. And as soon as you heard her voice, you was back over her house. Or if you moved out, and she went her way, and you went your way, you're walking down the street and you see her, and the butterflies start again. And before you know it, you're living together again. Yeah, y'all, somebody know. You don't have the power not to do what you know you should not do, that it's no good for you. It's not to your advantage. It's not to your well-being. And then one day, you get the power to walk away. And no matter what happens, you don't go back. Because your intuition and your conversations with God tell you that's not the best thing for you, son. I got something else for you. Just wait. Be patient. Just continue to do my will. I'll hook you up. Don't mean you don't love her no more. Just means that you can love her from afar. Don't mean you have to be with her. But she might not ever stop loving you. But you'll get the power not to go back. That's what's happened here with me and Heron. I am so grateful for my experience with Heron. My love affair with Heron got me here with you guys this whole weekend. My journey with Heron was so intense that it spoke to somebody and said, he's got a message to carry. Let me get him so he can deliver that message. Because he might touch somebody the same way he touched me. I don't not like Heron. I love him. Thank God. Thank you, God, for allowing me to go in and allowing me to come out and still love. Love is the key to everything. Love heals everything. And when I go back and I become willing to make this list, and I become willing to list the harm that I've done to people, and I've been willing to go back to repair that harm, there's a magic in that. For me, ninth step, my first set of amends is what hooked me. Hooked me the same way Heron did. Because I had horrific amends. And somebody in here, you're teeter-tottering on passing through and peeling the next layer because you probably need to make amends or you're in amends and you just won't do it because of fear of what they're going to do to you. But if you become willing to believe that God is everything he said he would be, you need confirmation of that. I needed confirmation. So them two sets of dope dealers that had contracts on me, that I'd owed thousands of dollars, I walked back into both of those lions' dens and made amends. Why? Because I knew if I didn't, I was going to shoot dope. And shooting dope was worse than me dying physically. For me to shoot dope would mean I would be dead. For 20-something years, I was dead. I wanted to live. And where did I get the hope from? I got the hope from Joe Hawk. And I got the hope from Mark Houston. And I got the hope for GW. I got the hope from Shelley. I got the hope from a bunch of people that had gone before me and had stepped through the ringer and came out the other side. So if it happened for them, why can't it happen for me? And I trudged forward. And my first set of amends hooked me. I had horrific amends. The process is to make the list. The process is to write the harm out. Now, I was introduced to two ways to make amends. There's a plus-minus system, plus-plus. I know where they are, and I'm willing to make amends, make the amends. Plus-minus, I know where they are, and I'm not willing to make amends. Minus-plus, I don't know where they are, but I'm willing to make amends. And minus-minus, I don't know where they are, and I'm not willing to make amends. And in my first couple pieces of work, I used the plus-minus system, and I started with the ones that I was willing to make. And they told me, you start with these, and by the time you get to the ones that you're not willing to make, you'll have the power to make them. And I had the power to walk into those two lions' den. They were lions, too. They killed people. They castrated people. I was able to go back to those stores that I boosted out of for 10, 15 plus years. And when I went back to New York and I said to my oldest brother, I'm back here on an amends trip. And he said, what the fuck are you talking about? I said, I'm back here because I need to clear up some stuff I did when I lived here before. I had been out of New York for a number of years. I said, I need to go back to these people in these stores downtown, and I need to make amends to them for all the stuff that I stole from them. And he just looked at me for like 5 minutes. He just looked. And he said, what the fuck is wrong with you? What they done did to you in Los Angeles? And I said, they didn't do nothing to me. I said, I'm thoroughly convinced, Junior, that if I don't do this, I'm shooting dope, man. And for me to shoot dope is to die. And he said, well, if you gotta go, he said, I'll go with you. He said, but I ain't going in them goddamn stores with you. Because he feared that I would be locked up. Nobody locked me up. One of them scared the shit out of me. Nobody locked me up. Nobody threatened me with prison. My first set of amends freed me. My first set of amends had me to adopt the phrase that God began to dance in between the raindrops. He began to show me just how powerful he was. He showed up. And he confirmed that decision I made in the third step. I'll be your father. What does a father do? A father protects his kids. He takes care of his kids. A real father. He's a provider. As a result of my financial amends and that first set of amends, my life skyrocketed with finances. Because them dope dealers, I've been getting to send them back a certain amount of money each couple of weeks. And whenever I can pay those debts back. And I paid them off. And my life straightened out financially. And so much other stuff, amends to women that I had kids by. I have four kids. One died before she was born. But all four of my kids were born in my addiction. All three of them were born in my addiction. All three by different women. My two sons, I was never a father to. Never. I had a love affair with Heron that stopped me. Made an amends to my oldest son's mother in my first set of amends and found out in making that amends, that years before, one of them groups of guys that I owed that money to grabbed her one night and raped her for my debt. Harm that I had caused that I knew nothing about. Found out that while I was just having some kind of a la-di-da, la-di-dee relationship, she had actually fell in love with me and loved me. And cried and boo-hooed when I made the amends. And said, I really loved you and you hurt me. But if I was able to stand there and take it and fit myself, the intent for step 9, to be of maximum service to God and the people about me. And I got free. When I came into the rooms in 1988, I haven't been back out. I stayed. I do the work on a consistent basis. And I don't do the work now because I have to. I do the work because I want to. I do the work because I know God is going to show up. And he's going to peel one more layer. And I'll be a better man than I was the last time I went through. And that's all I want. Just keep shaping and molding me and chipping away at me. Just keep doing it. You got far better a plan for me than I could ever have for my life. And what I do in the rooms is a thank you for what you've done. My mother was an evangelist. She gave me to my godmother when I was born. My godmother was a minister and a pastor. She gave me to her and said, here, take him. Shape him, mold him, armor him with God. And I did that for the first 8 years of my life. I'm who she wanted me to be today. I know she sees me. Somebody wants that. Somebody in here tonight, you want that. You might not have told nobody, but deep down within you, you want that. You want that recreation. You don't want to live the way you've been living. You've been fighting all your life, man. Fighting. Just to live. We got a solution. We got a way out. We got a pathway to recreation. And the pathway is steps 1 through 9. I guarantee you, you give it a shot and you put your all into it, the way you drank and the way you used or the way you shot dope or the way you smoked crack cocaine, I guarantee you God will show up. And if he don't, you call me and say, Mike, you a fucking liar. And I'll take the call and I'll listen to you. But I know what we do here works. I dare you. So 9th step is the ultimate surrender. And 4 through 9, you just keep shedding you, man. You just say to God, here, take me, man, take me. I can't deal with me no more. Take me. What else you want? Here, you can have that too. Just be willing. And watch what he does. Then you get to the end of the 9th step. And the 9th step promises only come true as a result of doing 1 through 9. So don't be looking for shit if you only did 1 through 9. Who am I talking to? The mad dog. Don't be looking for nothing. Book says half measures avail you nothing. There is no middle of the road solution. Don't be looking for nothing if you ain't did nothing. If you haven't taken any action, don't be looking for nothing. If you balked in your inventory, don't be looking for nothing. This ain't for wimps and punks. You had heart out there, have some heart in here. You sit in meetings and people talk about, oh, I can't write inventory. It hurts too much. It's too many feelings. I'm feeling too much. Get the medicine. You got the medicine out there. Get the medicine in here. Here's the medicine. The medicine is here. The medicine takes you to the solution, to the healing. Not the band-aid, the total healing. Ultimate surrender, nice stuff. For those of you that really want a recreation in your life, you really want it. You ain't here because this is a lovely thing to do. That's all I got right now.
Thanks, Brian. Wow. I believe what Mike believes, that the ninth step is the ultimate surrender. I've yet, and I've been sponsoring people since I had about 5 months. And so that's about 10 solid years of sponsorship. And I've yet seen anyone come back from a relapse that did not have unfinished amends. Okay? Very few people make all their amends. That's what I've picked up on in 10 years of sponsoring people. And let me explain why I believe the ninth step is the most important step in cultivating trust in God. Because our process here works like this. Our foundation in the first step makes us willing. We make a series of decisions. We take a series of actions. And we get some results. And we start to develop this thing called faith. And we stay willing. And we make some more decisions. And we get some more results. And somewhere along the way, the faith becomes trust. In my opinion, where it becomes trust is in our ninth step. See, my sponsor held my hand through the first 8 steps. And then he let go. And I had to go out into the world and make these amends. And the only presence that was going with me to make the amends was my higher power, my relationship with God. And what I was taught was to get clear on the harm that I created. I remembered what questions I had to ask. Did I leave anything out? Do we need to talk about this? Do you need to discuss how any of this made you feel? And what do I have to do to make things right between us? And I would sit in silence for a minute or two and I'd go make these amends. Now, when I got clean and sober, I didn't use the note cards until I ran into Mike a few years after I got clean and sober. In the beginning, it was a list of people I was going to do right now, a list of people I would do later, a third list was a maybe list, and then the never list. Right? That first 8-step list had about 150 ballpark people and institutions. Over my first 8.5 years, that list went from 150 to 230 people and institutions. About a year ago, I approached the last person on that list. Like I said earlier in the weekend, there's not a human being on this planet that I'm going to see walking down the street that's going to cause me to go across the street because I don't want to see this person. Or my behavior is going to change. Every amends that I am consciously aware of, I've made an approach. Now, granted, of those 230, I would have to say somewhere between 50 and 60 wanted nothing to do with me. They didn't respond. Typically, it was a 3-strike rule. I'd shoot them a messenger. You know, that's the reason I got on Facebook in 2008. Not to make amends. It was really easy to find people. The amends approach was pretty simple. Hey, I've been going back through my life trying to repair all the damage I've caused. It's quite clear that I've harmed you. Would you be willing to sit down so I can make things right? Boom. End of story. That's an approach letter. It's not an amends. Okay? Financial amends. I've paid back $19,000. I've still got another ballpark 20 to pay. Now here's the deal. I have, and I may have touched on this Friday night, but I'll say it again. 10 years, 120 months, over 80% of the time I have sent some type of financial amends back out into the universe. I paid back drug dealers. It took me 4 years. A guy gave me 1,000 hits of ecstasy and I took off on him. Disappeared. Took me 4 years to make that amends. November, this past November, I made my last payment. Paid him back all his money. This is just wasn't like a guy down on the block. You know, all the dealers on the block that I ripped off, I donated money to the Atlanta Union Mission, which is a homeless shelter down near where I used to cop. That's how I got right with them. This other guy invited me into his home. He was a friend of mine. Yeah, I bought a lot of drugs from him, but I broke bread with him, so I had to make it right. And I had several on my list like that. These just weren't drug dealers. I spent time with them. We hung out together. We spent time in each other's homes. They deserved much more. I can spend an entire day talking about amends, but I've got a few stories I have to share with you. Because I do believe that the first 9 steps are the launching pad into the world of the Spirit. The dimensions of 10 and 11, which require this, the language of the heart. Okay? And my capacity to access my heart and bring it into my prayer life and my meditation life has to have some correlation with the fact that I've spent this much time making these amends, that God has given me the willingness to make these amends. And the first one I want to share with you has to do with I slept with my best friend's fiance. All right, society says you don't come back from that. And when I did that, I devastated an entire group of friends. What I mean by that is people were forced to take sides. There were several people in the group of friends. And I'm talking about a group of like 20, 25 people. Some people knew what was happening and some were forced to keep it a secret. And they would come to us saying, if you guys don't tell him, we're going to tell him. Can you imagine the amount of stress that would put on a group of people? And so eventually it all came out. And it was devastating. And when I got clean and sober, every single person in that group of friends was on my amends list. And I had to go make amends to them all, and I did. And I sat down with him at a restaurant. It was very emotional. He yelled and cussed and cried. And I just sat there and listened and asked him what I could do to make it right. And we slowly began to rebuild our friendship. In 2010, I went to a retreat that this man was putting on in Atlanta, outside of Atlanta. And I don't know if you remember this, but he sent out an email and he said, I want everybody to bring something that means a great deal to you, some type of artifact. And that guy, who was one of my best friends, and I slept with his fiance, we'd rebuilt our relationship to the point where he gave me this gem that was wrapped as a pendant that you wore around your neck. So when I went to the retreat and I got up in front of everybody, I wanted to talk about the power of amends. The regenerative power of God to restore a relationship like that. I was able to do that. And I was able to make amends with the girl. There was a couple in that circle of friends. We used to meet, when they used to go out of town, she would house sit for them. And that was one of our rendezvous points. This story will illustrate the ripple effect of amends. Like, we really don't know the harm that we've caused. Just like the news Mike got when he made that amends. I got some news. And the news was, we used to use their apartment. Evidently, this one time, we didn't throw the condom away. So they had found a used condom in their bedroom. And that was in 2003. I was making this amends in 2008. For 5 years, they each thought the other person had cheated. They didn't believe each other about the story about where the condom came from. What if I had not become willing to make that amends? I think I probably turned ghost white in the restaurant when I was making that amends to them when they told me that. And that showed me that I really have no idea what the collateral damage of my actions truly are. I went to make an amends to the CEO of the company that I got, one of the companies I got fired from. His son was a friend of mine, and I used to sell him drugs, and I knew he was really, his mental health was unstable, and I kept on selling him drugs. And his son got me the job. And so when I went to make amends to the CEO, not only did I have to make amends for being fired after he vouched for me and got me the job, I had to make amends that I kept selling drugs to a son. And that was a really difficult amends. When I asked him what I could do to make it right, like, he had tears in his eyes, and he was so happy that I was clean and sober. He goes, I just want you to talk to my son, because he can't stop smoking meth. Right? And that's how I got to make that right. I wish I could report to you that his son got in the program and worked the steps, and that's not how that played out, but I completed the amends by having the conversation with his son. I walked in on my girlfriend cheating on me, caught her in the act. It was 2000. Red-handed. I stalked her all night. I knew she was cheating on me. Stalked her all night. Found her outside the bartender at her restaurant's apartment. Parked the car across the street. I went and bought a rose and put it on her car. And I sat across the street and waited until she came out at 7 in the morning. And she freaked out when she saw the rose because she knew I was somewhere around. So I break down the door and I go in there and it turns into an ugly scene. And,
You too, huh?
Yeah. And so that guy, his name's Tony, went on my never list. I'm never making amends to this guy. When I did my first inventory on her, my fourth column clearly showed me if I had been dating me, I would have cheated on me. So I knew she didn't cheat on me. I drove her into his hands. It was clear. But he was still an issue because after I caught them together and that incident happened, I proceeded to assassinate his character, get him cut off from people where he was buying his drugs. I would tell my friends not to hang out with him. If they kept hanging out with him, I quit hanging out. They weren't welcome. You know, that kind of twisted stuff. And so I think I had somewhere between 3.5 and 4 years, and it was in the middle. I worked a sales job, so I was drove around a lot, and I'm driving the part of town where his bar is one day, and Spirit says, it's time to make that amends. And I said, uh-uh. I tried to ignore the intuition because I was driving towards the bar, and it was the middle of the day, and he's a bartender, so the dialogue between me and Spirit was, you know what? I'll go in here. I'll show how willing I am to make this amends. Then this other voice says, you know, it's the middle of the day. He's not going to be there. But you can tell your sponsor that you tried anyway. And you'll look good in front of your sponsor. And so there's all these, like, you know, different turmoil inside of me about making this amends. But, like, the pull was coming from here. The pull to make the amends was coming from my heart. Not from my mind. I pulled into the restaurant. And I go into the bar area. And it's the middle of the afternoon, and he's like the main bartender, and he is behind the bar. And this is why it's so important. Remember when I was explaining why you don't look at your part, you look at for your own mistakes and where you had been at fault. If I had gone in there expecting him to make amends to me, I would have walked out maybe with a resentment. So I sat down, I said, hey, Tony, you got a few minutes? So we sat down in a booth, and I made my amends for all the harm that I created in his life. And the entire time I'm making my amends, this grown man is just waterfalls, tears coming out of his eyes. And he made amends to me. Okay? And so, but this is not the best part of the story. My father and I, our deal on most Sundays was we went out to eat and went to a movie. And we went to this bar a good bit because it was a really good restaurant too. And this guy, Tony, would just come over and shoot the shit with me and my dad. Over and over to the point where we walked into the bar and it was like screaming across the restaurant to this guy who I caught in bed with my girlfriend. Hey, what's up, man? How you doing? And we would converse. A year and a half ago, maybe a year and 9 months ago, I took one of my grand sponsees to lunch at this restaurant. Tony was there. And Tony and I embraced and we talked for like 5 minutes and just catching up. Well, I sit down with my grand sponsee. And I start telling him this story, and he said, you're lying to me. You and that guy act like you've known each other your entire life, and you've been boys the whole time. And I said, that's the power of making amends. This is the stuff we don't want to miss out on. One more. I wrecked a car when I worked for this valet company, and I got away with it. And it was a lot of damage. When I got sober, I went to the valet company, and the owner didn't own the valet company anymore. And he was really the guy that I owed the money to, because that's where it came out of his bottom line. I was kindly informed that he was now a district attorney in one of the largest counties in Georgia, prosecuting DUIs. So I was like, great. So I got his phone number. I called him up. I left him a voicemail. I get a call back, and he leaves me a message and says, hey, this, I can't remember if we talked or he left me a message. He goes, hey, is this about a 9-step amends? And I'm just like, holy crap. I said, yes, sir, it is. He goes, all right. You know, where he told me where his office was down at Fulton County. So I go down there, and I talk with him, and his mom's been sober and Alcoholics Anonymous for 42 years. And he used to own a valet company, which employed a lot of young men in the restaurant business, parking cars. He goes, I can't tell you the number of times I have gotten this phone call from someone wanting to make a 9-step amends. And so he didn't want his money, but he had had so much experience with it. He goes, I need you to donate it to this charity. Yeah. So I donated it to the charity. And I can sit up here all night and tell you stories about making amends. And so one more thing. See, I work in this industry, and I have to explain this to parents who say, well, my son's a good Christian. My son believes in God, right? My son has faith. And I tell them, that's not going to work. You need to have a direct experience with the power that provides you with that faith, with that grace, with the belief. And then I explain to them why it's so important to make these amends and why very few people do and how that step will solidify the trust in this relationship. That's why it's the ultimate surrender. So,
yeah, you have to basically see and feel God at work. I'd like to open it up. You have a question?
I just hear a lot of, you know, many things. I hear a lot of living amends.
Yeah.
Is that like acceptable? I mean, can you just be a better person and people will see the difference in you?
Well, living amends. I went to Austin, Texas, worked down there for a while with Mark. Came back to Los Angeles, Palm Springs, as a matter of fact, and then worked there for a couple of months, didn't like that, and I moved up to Los Angeles and moved in with my brother, who was older than me. It was only me and him left. And when I get there, I look at him and I said, something's wrong with you. And you know, anybody in here, a younger sibling that's got older brothers and sisters? It's like, you don't know what you're talking about, right? You don't have nothing to say here, right? And I'm telling Bobby, I said, man, something's wrong with you. How you doing? Oh, I'm okay. Ain't nothing wrong with me. I said, look, man, I've been knowing you all my life. Something's wrong with you. Long story short, I finally get him to go to the doctor, and he has Parkinson's disease. So I said, I told you something was wrong, and it's progressive. So as I'm living there these couple of months, he begins to get worse. So I had just left my ex-wife, which the divorce became final when I started living with him. And I went to him, and I said, yeah, I said, well, you know, I can't stay here forever. I said, I'm going to start looking for an apartment or a house, and I got to go to Retriever. We just traveled the country together, right? Start looking for a house for me and Deuce, and Spirit said, no, you're not. Spirit said, you're going to take care of him. He was one of my brothers that no matter what, how bad I got, he never closed his door. He never shut his back on me. He always, I would rob from him. They robbed him, came through the skylight and robbed him. I was in the living room, and the living room had a police lock, so they couldn't get in, right? And after they robbed the other rooms, I took what they hadn't taken. All this I revealed in an amends to him, right? Never turned his back on me, ever. And Spirit said, no, you're going to take care of him the way he's taken care of you all your life.
So what I did, I went back to him. I said, look, man, I'm not going to buy a house. I said, we're going to buy a house, and we're going to live together. And I'm going to look out for you. And I said, for however long. And I did that for about 3 years until his son, who lives in Atlanta, came and got him and took him to Atlanta. And that's where he died, a little over a year now, from Parkinson's, which got progressively worse. So that's a living amends. Some things that, you know, is better said than done.
Yeah.
I had made verbal amends to him, but, you know, then I was able to show him, look, man, I love you.
Yeah.
And this is what I'm willing to do. What I'd like to do is...
Can I say something about the living
amends?
Mm-hmm. So, I just want to be real specific. So no one's confused here. May direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so with injures them or others. We're not others, right? And so if there's a possibility to make a direct amends, then we make the direct amends. I think if you go to someone, you make the amends, you ask for forgiveness, they give you forgiveness. After that, it's about practicing principles in all our affairs. But I've watched people in my 10 years that have used living amends as a reason to not make the amends, especially when it comes to ex-spouses and ex-girlfriends. And some of the most powerful amends I ever made were ex-girlfriends.
Yeah.
Okay, so I just want...
Yeah. Go. I'm just thinking about family members. And just, you know, as an addict, I made so many amends for people. I was always sorry. I was always going back, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, but saying I'm sorry is not... an amend. Like you just said it. How many times have we said I'm sorry and have done the same thing over again?
Where my family, a lot of my family members would be like, just, you know, show us. Mm-hmm. We don't want to hear you. Like, we want to see it. We want to see you actually get...
That's with the family, though. Amends after a while. Mike's the one that taught me this. Amends with your family after over and over are bullshit after that point. That's not... I get that, but this is where sponsors are very useful, you know, because your ego will talk you into applying that logic to not only your family, but to everything.
Yeah.
So, sorry.
You want to make face-to-face amends whenever possible.
Yeah.
And just about all my amends, except if they were dead, and you can make amends to dead people. You can make amends if you're going to create harm. Or say you can't find the institution that you make money, that you owe money, like T said, you can give money to a charity. You know, early in my recovery, I'd send adopt a child or something where you send money to, and they send them money every week.
Yeah.
I did that, and yeah.
I think my experience with living the lives is like step 10 and doing step 10 on a daily, everyday basis, living like that and using that as my living amends, is my experience.
Mm-hmm. To who, though? I'm curious, who's the living amends to?
To whomever I've harmed or wronged in that moment.
So we're not talking about a past person you've harmed. And you could possibly track them down, but you've decided, okay, I'm going to live this way, and that's going to make that amends, right? I'm just curious.
Because, because my past amend would be, I would have already done them in step 9.
Okay.
Now, a living amend is just me living to show my family on a daily basis that I am doing what's right now, and I am...
You're different.
What's wrong.
Yeah. But wouldn't that be the same as practicing the principles in all our affairs?
Yeah.
Yeah, but you initially want to make a face-to-face amends if you've harmed them.
Mm-hmm.
Then after that, yeah, then you demonstrate the lifestyle.
Right.
So that, like you said, then they know, oh, something's different about her.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And yeah, she's really serious this time. And when they've closed you off and not accepted you since forever, they begin to welcome you back. I've heard people share it all the time. They gave me a key. And I ain't had a key in God knows when. You know? I'd like to open it up because we got a little bit of time. What we got next?
No, what do you think of doing a Q&A now?
Well,
and then do two sessions in the morning. Because I don't think this group's going to hang out for another session.
No, no, this was the last session anyway.
Now we have one more.
But what I wanted, no more tonight, but I wanted to involve you guys in it a little bit. And if anybody had the experience with making amends? Nobody else in here has made amends?
Yeah,
I'm making amends.
Okay, who'd be willing to share an experience with an amends that they had that, like, blew them away?
I'm gonna stop recording.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.